Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Stefan Irisch to the podcast. Stefan is the Polanski Fellow at the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute and the author of a terrific new book called Justifying Genocide, Germany and the Armenians from Bismarck to Hitler. The book is a comprehensive and insightful look at what Germans knew about the Armenian genocide, when they knew it, what they wrote and said about it, and how what they wrote and said mattered. It's a wonderful book, full of colorful quotations and insightful asides. And I'm looking forward to talking about the highlights of the book with Stefan. And so with that, Stefan, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So let's start out. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to be a historian, interested in Turkey and the Ottoman Empire and Germany.
I studied history in Berlin, and growing up in Germany, I was always interested in the various aspects of German history concerning its various minorities. Of course, you learn and read a lot about the Third Reich and the Holocaust, but growing up with many friends with Turkish and Southeast European backgrounds, I was very interested in that broader region, and especially the history of the Ottoman Empire, I found very interesting. And I also worked for some time on Romanian and Moldovan history. And lately it is Ottoman and modern Turkish history, and always connected with German and European history and more broader themes as well.
I see that you got a BA in London and then came back to Berlin for your MA and then PhD at Cambridge. How did that matter to you? What did it mean to you, or how did it help you or shape you that you went back and forth to get your education?
I still very much like the British university system, and I really enjoyed my time there. Basically, my time in Berlin was to slow down the whole education process a little bit. So instead of going on from my BA to do an MA in 1 or 2 years, I took some time and did a little bit of area studies, a little bit of history, and a little bit of languages in Berlin. And I really enjoyed that.
So am I right? It's your first book that's Ataturk in the German Imagination?
My first one in English, yeah. I had something else on Moldovan history before that.
Oh, how interesting. Why Ataturk?
Why Ataturk?
Yeah.
Ataturk is a really towering figure for the modern Turkish Republic and modern Turkish identity. And actually, coincidentally, I came across the public discourse in the Third Reich, and I found a little bit of this adulation of the Nazis, this fandom the Nazis displayed towards Ataturk. And later, when I was doing my when I was starting to do a PhD, I wanted to investigate that further, and this actually opened up a totally different and unexpected, political spectrum for the 1920s and 30s, and something that was hitherto really unknown. And I was really surprised to find out what I did find out.
And so then you moved on to the Armenian Genocide and the way it's perceived and discussed in Germany. Why did you decide to move there for your next topic?
It was also a little bit a side project, actually, of the Atatürk project. When I was looking at German public discourse in the newspapers, especially in the 1920s, there was a lot of debate also on the Armenian Genocide. And in the research literature, there was always this suggestion that Germany did not talk about the Armenian Genocide, or even that the fact that Germany didn't come to terms in the 1920s after the First World War, that Germany didn't come to terms with the Armenian Genocide and its own role in it, that this, in fact, was a signal for the Holocaust. And as I went along reading these newspapers and reconstructing public discourse for my book on Atatürk, I found more and more articles on the Armenian Genocide, and I was very surprised. And then putting it all together actually is what I call in my book on the Armenians now, the Great German Genocide Debate. So, you know, it's quite the opposite actually of not coming to terms with it. Actually, Germany, I think, was home to one of the largest, if not the largest, genocide debate to date before the Holocaust.
So if that's the kind of core of the book, why do you start with, so turning to the book, if that's the core of the book, why start with Bismarck?
Well, you could say modern German history always starts kind of with Bismarck. But in this case, I think it's interesting because Bismarck's time, that's also the time when the Armenians enter the, let's say, public consciousness of the world around the Congress of Berlin and the Treaty of Berlin. This is kind of the time when the Armenians become really an international topic. And what is interesting about Bismarck's time is that certain policy, you could say traditions that become much more important in the 1890s and afterwards already are being developed and being pursued. And we know that the Ottoman Empire was an ally of Germany in the First World War. And we might also know that only really shortly before the Ottomans entered the war, there was actually a formal alliance. But already since Bismarck's time, some sort of informal or quasi-alliance exists. And it's also starting with Bismarck's time that Germany, let's say official governmental political Germany, adopts a very cynical attitude vis-a-vis the Ottoman Armenians.
So Bismarck and the foreign political policy officials of the Reich adopt a certain set of attitudes and policies toward the Ottoman Empire and Armenia. Why? How do they see the Ottoman Empire being useful to the German Empire, to this new Germany? And what role, how does that place a set of roles, or what does that mean for the Armenian question?
Well, on the one hand, Bismarck tries to divert tensions in Europe away from the center to the periphery. And in this respect, the Ottoman Empire seems very helpful. And to some extent, Bismarck is also willing to give away parts of the Ottoman lands to other European powers to kind of satisfy various hungers and ambitions. But at the same time, in order for the Ottoman Empire to fulfill this kind of function, it has to continue to exist in some fashion so that there wouldn't be an all-out European war over the Ottoman spoils. So this is the one thing. Bismarck kind of has this grander European vision in which the Ottoman Empire can be useful. At the same time, there's also a growing interest as time moves along in the Ottoman Empire as something of a partner, because Germany feels encircled by France and Russia and doesn't have many partners in Europe. And this is the broader context, and the Armenians are kind of a nuisance, an obstacle, but also a chance for Bismarck's Germany already. Not speaking out for the Armenians can help the German Empire to become closer to the Ottomans. And this already starts under Bismarck and is very pronounced then in the 1890s and also, of course, later on.
Go ahead. Sorry.
And this is not only the historian now, seeing something in the times that people at the time perhaps were not able to see or saw differently. Thinkers of empire, German thinkers of empire and political thinkers, after the massacres in the 1890s, about which we probably want to speak a little bit too, these mm-hmm. thinkers already said that Germany's position in the Middle East and the Ottoman Empire was actually bought with Armenian blood. So this German silence, which is a very active silence, you could say, has a very deep political meaning, and Germany hopes and actually is able to be rewarded for this silence in Armenian matters.
You talk about active silence, and you mentioned the massacres of the 1890s. To what extent are those massacres known about in Germany? How did Germans respond?
So these massacres, they took place from 1894 to 1896. For 3 years, there were a series of pogroms and massacres in various localities in the Ottoman Empire, also in Constantinople. And the reception in Germany, there are always two broad groups, you could say, or groupings. Yeah. On the one hand, you have pro-Armenian activists, mostly from Protestant missionary circles, who are deeply involved in missionary work in the Near East. And on the other hand, you have very strong factions of nationalist pro-Ottoman politicians and mm-hmm. newspapers especially. So it is at the beginning is always these pro-Armenian activists, mostly these Protestant missionary circles, who try to create awareness, who try to publish reports of these massacres and analyses, witness accounts, and so on. And then you have already from the beginning of these massacres, pro-Ottoman and also quasi-German governmental public opinion and press, which tries to minimize these massacres, justify whatever is happening, and tries to smear and silence the pro-Armenian sections of the press.
One of the points you stress, so you talk about justification, and that's a word we're going to come back to later in a later debate. One of the things you stress is the way in which German conceptions of Armenians become racialized in and after this period. Can you say a little bit about how Germans talked about Armenians and understood what it meant to be an Armenian during kind of broadly this period and then as it becomes more racialized?
Yes, this is indeed a really important part of the whole narrative that develops and also of my analysis of it. Already from the 1890s onwards, there's this strong tendency to see the Armenians mainly in racial terms and not in religious terms. The Armenians were fellow Christians. But if you look at the newspapers and other forms of public discourse in these years, in the 1890s, you will always find them perceived through the either national or racial prism. And there is this tendency also from diplomats stationed in the Ottoman Empire and others to see the Armenians as the Jews of the Orient. You have to remember, of course, that at that time there weren't many Jews living in the Middle East, mm-hmm. but the Armenians, especially in Anatolia and the Levant, were very present in the cities, but also in rural areas, of course. And the view is actually, and also the discourse actually about the Armenians, is kind of like a carbon copy of modern anti-Semitism. Modern anti-Semitism, meaning anti-Semitism based on race rather than religion, the older version, And all these various racial stereotypes and also narratives which make up modern racial anti-Semitism also are being played out, are being used in German anti-Armenianism. And it's very telling in these debates in the 1890s already that race and national stereotypes, national characteristics become so important. I think it's also a way, especially for the pro-Ottoman voices, to overcome the fact that they are justifying, or at least justifying German silence, if it's not really justifying the violence against these Armenians, that they're talking about fellow Christians, actually. So race is also very instrumental, I think, in these years, but it develops its own logic and dynamics afterwards. Because on the other hand, outside these, let's say, more focused debates about the Armenians and violence against the Armenians in the 1890s, there is, since the 1890s, of course, also a growing literature on race, anthropology of race, and all these. And as time moves on to the 1920s and 30s, the Armenians are an integral part of the debate around, for example, the Aryan thesis. So the Armenians, they speak Indo-European language, and this whole of the Aryans rests upon a common language family, which then is transformed into a common racial family. And the Armenians, due to this logic, should be part of this racial family. However, already since many decades before, they've always been understood and described as being either related to the Jewish race or the Jews, or even being something of a parent race to the Jews. So the Armenians are always a bit of a puzzle for these racial theories, and they're always part and parcel of these discourses.
So where are the points of contact? In other words, to what extent are the people writing about the Armenians in this way? How are they getting their impressions of Armenians? How many Germans actually go to the Ottoman Empire and travel in the Armenian populated areas compared to how many of them are getting their ideas from Ottoman officials or just from kind of travel reports or journalistic reports? How does that all play out?
I think the majority of Germans who talk about the Armenians and write about the Armenians have their knowledge indeed from travel reports and second and third hand. There are some, again, some important people in these discourses who actually travel to Eastern Anatolia, for example, where the where Armenians live, but they have a different view because they also meet Armenians who are farmers, who are not in trade, who are not rich, but who are poor. And this kind of helps put them in a different position than the others who rely on travel reports, mostly to cities where they portray the stereotypical Armenian trader or merchant, very rich, living as they portrayed off the honest work of the Turks and so on. So, of course, there is a difference here, but it's very interesting to see how kind of closed this anti-Armenistic discourse is from early on, and how conflicting experiences in people's own travels or in their reception of other people's texts actually does not change the overall anti-Armenian discourse in Germany.
Interesting. Well, let's turn to World War One, and maybe I could start by asking you, how much did the German government know about what was happening in to the Armenians, and how did they know it?
Yes, that's an interesting question. The short answer would be the German government was well informed and knew almost everything. I think there's no other government except for the Ottoman government that knew as much about the genocide in progress as the German government. The Germans had a vast consular network still. They had their consuls all over eastern and southern Anatolia. And from the first days and weeks of the deportations and massacres, these consuls write very detailed reports about what is happening. And most of them already from the beginning start pleading with their own ambassador and their own government to help the Armenians and to stop genocide.
So if they're communicating back to their government, what kind of, and asking, at least to some extent, for help and assistance, what does the government say in response?
Well, the thing is, they're not mostly communicating directly with Berlin, with the government, mm-hmm. but have to go through their ambassador in Constantinople. And until later in the summer of 1915, until then, the ambassador stays relatively pro-Ottoman and anti-Armenian. And even though his consuls send him reports of what is happening on the ground, he's distorting and disputing whatever they are sending him, and mainly transports to Berlin what is Ottoman propaganda in these first months. And these are the hot months of the genocide, and his role there is very tragic in this respect. However, and in more in general, the German government is not willing really to intervene for the Armenians. Mm-hmm. When the German chancellor, a few months later, feels the pressure from various parts of Germany, from his diplomats, from these missionary circles who are well informed and others, he actually makes it very clear that it's much more important to hold Turkey on Germany's side than to intervene for the Armenians. And he basically plainly stated that it doesn't matter if Armenians die over this or not. And this is the unfortunate German role indeed during World War One. Later on, after the summer of 1915, there were some protests, but very timid and very ineffectual. Germany was more concerned with the war as such and with keeping Turkey in play than with humanitarian concerns for the Armenians.
So what if all of this got into the newspapers? How much could an average German have learned about what was going on?
Well, on the one hand, there was censorship, and it's been assumed until now, actually, that during World War One, nothing really reached the German population and the newspapers. However, while it is true that they couldn't have learned the full extent of what was happening, atrocity propaganda was an integral part of World War One political culture on all sides. And when the Armenian genocide began, April 1915, and as it progressed, German society was already, German public society, the newspapers, they were already engaged in a very heated war with the Entente countries about various atrocity allegations. For example, what the German occupational regime in Belgium was doing. So when allegations came, addressed to the Ottomans that they were massacring Armenians, the German press felt compelled to respond to defend the Ottomans, as sections of the press had already done in the 1890s, for example. Same kind of dynamics. But this time, during World War One, of course, the pro-Armenian side was entirely lacking. So there was information about the Armenians. It was couched in propaganda terms, and it was part and parcel of this atrocity propaganda warfare, basically. But German newspapers reacted, especially in this first year, 1915, of the Armenian genocide. And again, it's either they wanted to minimalize or justify whatever was happening. And one of these major discursive tools of justifying and supporting the justifying the violence and supporting the Ottomans was this image of an Armenian stab in the back. Mm-hmm. So it was often alleged that the Armenians, that the Armenians were rising up against the Ottoman state, and in the back of the Ottoman army, which was struggling against the Russian army, and basically as one concerted action, one concerted uprising, threatening the survival of the Ottoman state as such.
So that kind of links maybe the war and the immediate post-war discussion. And maybe we can start that by asking you to talk to us a little bit. I think it's Johann Lepsius. I think I've got that name right. Can you talk about him and his role in the pre-war and wartime years, and then maybe what he's asked to do immediately after the war is done?
Yeah, Johannes Lepsius is a very interesting figure. Yeah. Already in the 1890s, I always come back to the 1890s. Already back then, he published a big report on what was happening to the Armenians. This was actually a decisive moment in Germany where the general mood, for a moment at least, became pro-Armenian. After being active during these massacres in gathering information and setting up networks for the Armenians, for the survivors in Anatolia, he basically was pushed into a life of pro-Armenian activism. And he continued to look after Armenians in various projects in eastern Anatolia, but also to do publicity work in Europe. And again, during the war, he traveled to Constantinople, and he actually met Enver Pasha, one of the three leaders of the Ottoman Empire at the time. He met him to get him to stop genocide. And upon returning back to Germany, he gave a lecture in German parliament, mainly to the German press, which, of course, couldn't use what he was telling them. And he compiled another report based on his sources at the German embassy, but also the American embassy, on what was happening to the Armenians. And this report, because there was censorship, he sent out secretly to reporters, parliamentarians, and also to all the German Protestant parishes. So there was a section of elite Germany which could have known very much about the Armenian genocide as it was happening. But of course, it was only after World War I that this could really be discussed in public. And here, as you mentioned, what is so fascinating about Lepsius and his role in this topic is that in 1919, the German Foreign Office tasked him to edit a volume of documents from the German Foreign Office communication during World War I, a whole volume of documents on the Armenian genocide. And the reason for that is quite simple, and it goes back to really 1915. Germany was accused of being co-responsible or even the instigator of the Armenian massacres. And the German Foreign Office became very nervous already in 1915 and began collecting documents showing actually that they acted for the Armenians and tried to save them, which of course to that extent wasn't really true. So this volume of documents that Lepsius was tasked to edit and publish served the same purpose. It was mainly meant to address the world and the Entente countries who were gathered in Paris to decide on the peace treaties. It was mainly meant to free Germany of this allegation of being co-responsible or even the instigator of the Armenian genocide. But this kind of backfired for the German Foreign Office. The book was published already in the summer of 1919, and led to the first instances of the debate on the Armenian genocide in Germany. Already in this summer, German newspapers in long editorials discussed what had happened to the Armenians, with all different aspects pertaining to genocide, intent, extent of the genocide, motivations, repercussions, and all the gory details of what happened to the Armenians.
So let's, maybe we can pause just a moment and ask about word choices, because of course the word genocide has a particular kind of import in the world after the Genocide Convention and after Raphael Lemkin. What words are being used in this, kind of broadly speaking, in World War I by Lepsius in this discussion in 1919-1920, and maybe even before in the 1890s? What kind of German words are being used to describe these events? And are those words that are functionally equivalent to genocide, or are they more talking about these as broad massacres or human rights violations or something like that?
Yeah, that's indeed very important. And of course, the book and the narrative and the analysis has to deal with the counterclaim that it is anachronistic to use the term genocide mm-hmm. before the mm-hmm. convention, of course, or before Raphael Lemkin coined the term. However, when we talk about how the events during World War One were understood and discussed in post-war Germany, I think the label genocide is well warranted. The constructs they use in German at this time are either extermination, annihilation of a nation or of a race or of the Armenians. And the way they discuss these, what happened to the Armenians already after this publication of the German Foreign Office documents, is always that they're interested in the systematic killing of Armenians. So mm-hmm. for them, it is very clear that this goes beyond massacres, spontaneous pogroms, or anything of the like. And that is very different to what world history knew up to this point. So mm-hmm. it's like it's part and parcel of the description, but also of the discussion and the analysis that these editorials and op-eds in these years contain. You ask about German terms, what is really interesting and fascinating on the one hand, but in the long run not as important perhaps, is in the 1890s already a similar language is used, not to the full extent, but it marks one of the first times that the German equivalent term to genocide, Völkermord, murder of a people, is used actually in the public realm in Germany. However, later on in the 1920s, this is not a very common term and is not widely used at that point. But as I said, the other constructions, mainly dealing with extermination, annihilation of a people, are very similar, I think. And I think the way what happened to the Armenians is discussed in these years makes it very clear that it's a debate about genocide because, as I said earlier, it was also a debate about intent, motivation, and all these things. It was about the nature of what had happened, really.
So you suggest in your book that the aftermath of the killing of Talat and then the trial played a really critical role in the way this discussion evolved. So can you say a little bit about the trial and how it ended up and the way the people involved in the trial talked about the killing and why it happened?
Yes, indeed. In 1921, Talat Pasha, one of the three leading men of the Ottoman Empire during World War One, was assassinated in Berlin in broad daylight in a crowded shopping street. And what is interesting, we talked about 1919 and the publication of the Foreign Office documents. Afterwards, there was this short period of a few weeks, a few months, when this Foreign Office publication was discussed in the German press. People displayed outrage. There were some people already trying to minimize what had happened. But then, a little bit later, there began this long year until early 1921 of a backlash where especially pro-Ottoman and German nationalist papers tried to justify what had happened or just to minimize the extent of what had happened, even though the German Foreign Office documents were really clear on that. And this this kind of dynamic between acceptance and then backlash already played out in the 1890s and also during World War One. And now again, you could say something rather at first external to the debate occurred that pushed the debate further. And this was now in early 1921, the assassination of Talat Pasha in Berlin, indeed. At first, again, attempts to portray him as a very generous nationalist Ottoman statesman, to minimize all the things that were alleged during World War One, and only gradually the attempts to create a little bit awareness about the Armenian connections. And then 3 months later, in the summer of 1921, his assassin is on trial in Berlin. A young Armenian by the name of Somon Telirian. And everything seems to be clear because he was caught right after the assassination. He confessed repeatedly to having assassinated Talat Pasha. However, again, the German Foreign Office, for example, is scared of this trial, that it turns into something political and more about the Armenians than about the assassination itself. And so there is pressure to keep the trial short, for example. And it was short indeed. It only lasted 1.5 days, but it became one of the most spectacular trials of the 20th century, I guess, and definitely of the time and in Germany, because at the end of it, Somon Telirian, the assassin who confessed so many times to the deed, was acquitted and let go. And that's quite fascinating. And even at the beginning of the trial, he acknowledged again. He said, "Yes, I killed Talat Pasha." And this is kind of interesting because it encapsulates already the whole direction of the trial. He had a strange ally in the courtroom, the judge, who pushed from the beginning, pushed the trial towards the Armenian genocide and the Armenian broader topic. And so the trial from the very first minutes becomes a trial about the Armenian genocide, and Talat Pasha, the victim, actually becomes the perpetrator and the defendant, you could say, actually. Huh. And Telirian's defense has a lot of interesting people in the courtroom, Lepsius again as well, but also Armenians living in Berlin, survivors of the Armenian genocide, and also an Armenian bishop at the time in Manchester, who tell the court, the jury, and the press all the gory details of what happened to them. And the courtroom is visibly outraged, as is then the German public when these tales of horror and atrocity are reprinted in the German press. So when Telirian is acquitted, the German newspapers, you can really feel that from the coverage. They gave the trial a lot of coverage. The German newspapers are shocked, and it takes the newspapers quite a long time, actually, to digest what just happened there. And the next days and weeks are filled again with editorials and op-eds discussing what happened in the courtroom, what happened to the Armenians again. They discuss the testimonies, they discuss, again, the motivations, the intent, extent of genocide, and so on and so forth. Huh. And still 8-9 months later, there are op-eds and editorials on the topic in the German papers. So this is really a huge event. And it's also really important because it pushes over all of the German published opinion, all of the German press, towards accepting this charge of genocide, of annihilation, extermination of a nation, planned, intended, and executed by the Young Turk leadership. Even those papers, pro-Armenian, pro-Ottoman, and German nationalist, who tried to deny whatever happened or the extent of what had happened in the years before, even they now have to acknowledge that what had happened was something akin to genocide, to the murder of a nation. And this is quite fascinating, actually. The mood is so strong in this summer of 1921 that there's no other discursive option anymore. Huh. But then again, there's a large backlash. And this is really interesting. Now, these nationalist, hyper-nationalist papers still want to make a point for the Ottomans, for the Young Turk leadership. And now they openly justify what even they acknowledge is genocide. So then for months you have arguments, discourses printed in German newspapers justifying genocide.
What? How much attention are other countries paying to Armenian, what happened to their Armenians at this point? Is Germany unique or unusual or typical?
In a way, Germany is typical, I think, because Germany is unique, I think, because Germany is was so closely involved with the Ottomans and was an ally during World War One and had to fend off all these allegations of being either the instigator or at least co-responsible for what had happened. And so I think the debate after World War One was more intense and there was more sustained interest, at least in the opinion makers, in the newspapers. There was much more sustained interest in the topic than in other countries. Other countries, too, discussed the Armenians because they had been exposed to a lot of information on the Armenian genocide during World War One already, to a much larger and detailed extent than was possible in Germany. Germany was also catching up, you could say, with the rest of the world in these post-war years. And on the other hand, other countries were mainly focused on the debates in Paris, what would happen to the Armenians at the Paris Peace Treaty negotiations, whereas in Germany, this was much more a domestic topic, I would say, and it involved national sensibilities much more than in other countries.
So in the last section of the book, you turn and you try and assess the degree to which this influenced Germans, in particular right-wing Germans in the 30s and 40s, and how it relates to the Holocaust. So to what degree are members of the Nazi Party and other people on the far right, how aware are they and how do they understand this debate and discussion about genocide in Armenia?
Well, the Nazi Party, of course, over the 1920s and 30s undergoes strong and fast transformations when it comes to membership. But when I was talking about this great German genocide debate in the post-war years from 1919 to 1923, these are, of course, also the years in which the Nazi movement comes into being. And I would argue that as a political movement, the Nazis grew up with these debates around the Armenian genocide. It's interesting to note that even though the Nazis themselves were very interested in what was happening in Turkey at the time, after World War One, the Turkish War of Independence, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk fighting against especially the Greeks, the Nazis were very interested in that and also in this figure, Mustafa Kemal Pasha. They did not contribute much on the debate about the Armenian genocide directly. However, there was one very, I think, paradigmatic series of articles in one of the Nazi newspapers in the summer of 1923, where the Nazis tried to formulate various Turkish lessons for Germany. And one of the three key points was the purification, national purification, as they called it. And this discussed the Armenian genocide as well as the Greek-Turkish population transfer later on. And here again, you have a very open justification of genocide. And the same rhetoric is then a year later when after the failed Hitler putsch of late 1923, next year there is the big trial of the conspirators of the Hitler putsch, the failed one. And there again you have this open justification of genocide when the Turkish model for the Nazis is discussed. And again, because we always operate under the assumption that in the early 1920s, the Nazis could not really have imagined exterminating the Jews. We have one contemporary newspaper reader, a German Jewish author, who in his book, which appeared 2 years later, in 1925, I think, who responds to these articles about the Turkish role model and the discussion of the Armenians, and who writes there, if these Turkish lessons as the Nazis understand them applied to Germany, it would mean the death of all the Jews. So there is something there, and there is, of course, much more. As I sketched in my previous book, the Nazis were fascinated by Atatürk and the new Turkey that followed after World War One, and in the Third Reich, they paint this rosy picture of a post-genocide country of a post-genocidal wonderland, you could say, where everything is just perfect and the nation is active, revigorated, rebuilding itself. It's in their discourse just wonderful, but it's always a precondition to get rid of the minorities first if you want to emulate this Turkish model. And this is a very clear message that's transported in these books and articles about the new Turkey and the Third Reich.
So you bracket the book with a discussion of a novel, actually, 40 Days of Musada, I think I've pronounced that right, perhaps not, by Franz Werfel. Can you say something about Werfel and what he was trying to do with this novel and why you decided to both end and begin and end the book with him?
Well, his book is very interesting and very special in this respect. So Werfel decided to write this already before he actually went into his hot writing phase. But in late 1932, writing this book and getting it published was very urgent for Franz Werfel. Franz Werfel is from was from Prague, very renowned German author with a Jewish background. And he wanted to write this book, The 40 Days of Musada, this book about the Armenian genocide, as a warning to Germany, a warning against Hitler. So in late 1932, it was becoming clear that at least Hitler being part of the government, or the Nazis being a greater part in government and German politics, was on the immediate horizon. And Werfel wanted to finish his book in time. He failed, of course, but he was already touring Germany in the winter 1932-33 with some chapters from the unfinished book. For example, the chapter in which Lepsius, whom we met, meets Enver Pasha in Constantinople and tries to get him to stop genocide. And it's very interesting that for even the reviewers of these of the Werfel, even for contemporary reviewers in this winter, it is clear that Werfel is used to address the Germans and to warn them of the Nazis and of Hitler. So I think it's building upon our preconceptions of the time about what people could have imagined Nazism would mean for Germany and what it couldn't. I think it's very interesting and very important to realize that people like Franz Werfel thought that the Armenian genocide was something that was of immediate relevance to Hitler coming to power in Germany. And of course, this prism of perceiving the Armenians as the Jews of the Orient, and the whole fact that always when the Armenians were discussed in Germany, people were also discussing to some extent the Jews and the Jewish question in Germany. This kind of gives, I think, Werfel's novel a very crucial importance, and is a very interesting window into these times. And you said I also close my book with Werfel's novel. This is also because this novel, in the end, didn't become a German or a Jewish novel. It became an Armenian novel, basically. Because for one, Werfel failed to... He only published it in late 1933. And shortly after it was published in Germany, it was confiscated and forbidden. But still, it had quite a stellar career in the world. It was translated fast into English, became a bestseller. It was also translated into Hebrew, Polish, and other languages. And again, showing this connectedness, and actually it's a Jewish-German context. It became in the Nazi imposed ghettos in East during World War II. And read Franz Werfel's saga about Armenian survival on the mountain Musada as their own story, and they saw themselves in Armenian shoes and reflected upon their situation through an Armenian perspective as well. So I thought it was very interesting to realize how close the Armenian genocide was to the people in the Third Reich, in the in occupied Eastern Europe, and during the Holocaust even. Because it's this suggestion implicit in many historical books that the two, the Armenian genocide and the Holocaust, are separated by a great distance in time and space. And I think I uncovered some actually much closer for the people, for these societies, for the politics of the time. And I think that's something we will have to think about a little bit more. What does it mean if these two great genocides of the 20th century are so closely connected, actually?
That seems an appropriate place to end. We've asked you a lot of your time. I very much appreciate it. It's a wonderful book. I have to say, it's going to force me to sit down for an hour or two tomorrow and change the class preparation that I have for my class tomorrow afternoon. But that's a good thing, I think. I always ask guests the last couple questions, and I'll ask you. First, can you suggest one or two books or movies or something that you would recommend to the listeners that were important to you through this project, whether that's a memoir or a historical work? What should my listeners read or watch this weekend?
Yeah, perhaps not surprising. Indeed, I would actually suggest them to read Franz Werfel's 40 Days of Mussadar. Mm. It's a bit lengthy, and the language, even in the English translation, is a bit convoluted perhaps at times, but it's a very interesting novel, and some Israeli historians call it the first Holocaust novel, and I think that's what it is indeed, and it's a very interesting piece of literature, I think.
I will have to put that on my reading list. And then what are you working on now?
Well, I have a couple of projects. One of them deals with Enver Pasha, this leader of the Ottoman Empire during World War I. He's, I think, one of the most fascinating personalities of the 20th century, indeed. He's really in many aspects all over the place. He dies in Central Asia. He fights as a Muslim resistance fighter in what is now Libya before the First World War. He's responsible for one of the greatest military disasters of the Ottomans during World War I. He's just a fascinating figure that doesn't give up, that almost always fails, but always comes back to his feet, even though he dies very young. And so far, I think has been he hasn't been looked at enough, really, in our historical writing and analysis.
That sounds like a great project. We've taken a lot of your time. I hope when you're done with that, that you'll come back on the show and talk about it with us. But until then, thanks so much for being with us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to an interview with Stefan Erich, author of Justifying Genocide: Germany and the Armenians from Bismarck to Hitler. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join me next time when I interview Uğur Ümit Ungur about his edited volume, Genocide: New Perspectives on Its Causes, Course, and Consequences. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.